It is my pleasure now to introduce our first 30-minute speaker, Alan B. from Los Angeles.
Good afternoon. My name is Alan Bernstein. I'm an alcoholic. And thank you for being here. Thank you, Kevin and Chris, for inviting me. I'm sort of a fill-in for Matt Jay, who's my sponsor. And if you're wondering how someone so handsome and youthful looking is an old timer, I am too. I got sober April 16th of 1990, and I have 34 years of sobriety. And for some reason, June, I think you know her, but I could be making this up. I do that sometimes. When I was new, I was absolutely prepared to be on an old-timers panel, and so I listened very carefully to find out how much time you had to be an old-timer. And Francine W. was living in New York at the time, and she had 14 years. And if you don't know Francine, she is very articulate, very educated, very well put together, and she declared at 14 years with a great deal of certainty that 10 years was a requirement to be an old-timer. And I was brand new, and I believed it, and in 1990 it may have been 10 years. I can assure you that it has been moving ever since, and the only thing I've sort of figured out is you have to be a baby boomer to be an old-timer, and therefore I'm never quite going to make it, and that's fine. I think we can acknowledge that at the very least 34 years is a solid start, and I did get sober in New York. I was 25. I had been drunk for about a decade, the good news is you've got Bob after me, who has done this many times and knows how to do it. He'll clean up any spills that I leave, I'm sure. I suspect that part of it is my story, and part of it is a bit of whatever my experience of the history of AA is. And while my story is a drinking story, mostly cheap American beer and a little bit of recreational crack cocaine, I want to assure you, if you're new and you're in the middle of this debate, in 1990 it had been well resolved in New York that when we were talking about sobriety, we meant everything. It meant alcohol and drugs. I am intrigued and amused and a little baffled in recent years that people are acting as though this is not a resolved question in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I suffer from alcoholism, but I, in my experience, will medicate it with anything that is reasonably available. And certainly, as I mentioned, beer really was my preferred thing. It was accessible, it was legal, and I liked the process of getting drunk over a period of many hours. And I didn't want to get anywhere too fast. I think if you move slowly, there's less danger. And so I arrived in New York in 1990. What had happened was I'd had a nasty run of it, and I decided to give up drinking for Lent, which I'm Jewish and. But I'd grown up in Chicago suburbs, very Catholic suburbs. I know more of the Latin Mass than anyone my age. I lacked a vocabulary to tell you that I'd been drunk for a decade and it had stopped working and that I was afraid. I didn't know how to say that. And by making it a joke, nobody asked me tough questions like, why are you not drinking, that I didn't have an answer for. And if you're new especially, to me one of the things that's amazing about life in Alcoholics Anonymous, where we do speak this language of the heart, is that I can express fears and vulnerabilities here at the podium and feel safe doing it in a way that I literally did not know was possible. I knew how to drink in bars. I knew how to hustle drinks. I knew how to lie. I was really good at lying, and I reached a point in my drinking that I think many, not all, but many do, where I actually increasingly was uncomfortable telling you the truth. I would rather sort of make up a story. I had great stories about being from Alaska, a state that I had never visited before I was maybe 20 years sober, but I sold them well, and I felt them. I told you stories about traumas that had happened to me in my childhood that had not happened to me, but they were effective for getting to buy me drinks and occasionally wanting me to have a positive sexual experience. And that was what I came out of. And so I don't believe in being vulnerable. I don't believe in being honest. I believe in self-medicating. I don't believe that you are going to fix my problems. I know that some of you are well-intentioned. I suspect some of you are not, but I don't expect anyone to be able to fix my problem. I just want to medicate my own discomfort and control my limited and shrinking world as best I can. And then it abandons me. And like I said, I get sober for Lent. And on Easter Sunday, here's what happens for me, by the way, when I'm physically sober with that Alcoholics Anonymous, I get manic. I sort of bounce off of walls, and I'm crazy, and I'm physically sober, but I'm not well, and I have a lot of energy, and I wind up at a club called the Sound Factory on Easter Sunday, and it's 2 or 3 in the morning, and the Sound Factory was really cool, like Madonna would like show up there, and this is like when she still looked like Madonna, and I'm dancing because I got all this energy, and at 2:30 in the morning, I start chatting with someone who's sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and in the 12 and 12, in the third step, it talks about faith, and the approach to faith as being like a locked door with an invisible keyhole, and it says willingness can sort of make the keyhole appear and open the door. And I don't know exactly what it was. I think what it was that the Sound Factory was very cool. I was surprised they let me in. And this person was having fun and seemed cool, and they were in AA. And I want to admit that I'm a big fan of contempt prior to investigation. I've never been to an AA meeting, but I think contempt prior to investigation saves a lot of time and effort on my behalf. And so I'd already figured out what was wrong with AA, which was vague because I'd never been, but had a lot to do with AA's good for somebody, but they're like a lot older. They're like me now, but anyway, 1990. And that meeting somebody on a dance floor who was sober was enough to get me into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on Easter Sunday. It is a very Catholic story for a nice Jewish boy. I acknowledge that. And I was not a vision for you. I was not happy to be here. I did not, I didn't know what AA offered. What I did know is I'd been lying for a long time. And if none of you have ever been to New York meetings, New Yorkers are not in AA, or not the happiest people in general, but they are the most honest people. They are just breathtakingly honest. And I am a drunk liar. And I am going to tell you, to this day, I believe that there's a quality in AA that we know when we're telling the truth and we know when we're laying it on too thick. It doesn't mean that I always want to hear your truth, but there's a quality to the truth in an AA meeting that can't be escaped. And I was fascinated by what struck me as both the bravery and the absolute stupidity of being that vulnerable in front of a bunch of people, and sort of the self-assurance that people in AA brought to that. And I kept coming back, and I got some time, and I worked the steps. And, you know, I didn't know. I'm sober a third of AA's history. Bob is sober well more than half. I didn't know, because I wasn't really thinking about the big picture, and I wasn't thinking about staying for decades, that I was going to have the privilege of being a part of AA, that I was going to meet people along the way who were giants, some of whom you know and some of you don't. There was a man in those meetings in my early days, Father Michael Judge, who was just a guy in the meetings. He was the first recorded fatality on the 9/11 attacks. He's going to be a saint. Literally, he's going to be a saint, and should be. And, you know, he was just somebody in my meetings. And I'm not saying you're saints, but I'm saying you might be sitting next to one. You never know. And I moved out here when I was about 3.5 years sober. And I landed badly because I took my will back. And I need to put in a plug for my own experience that this is a one-day-at-a-time program, and that I can put a lot of days together in a very good way, and if I take my will back, I will start to unravel. That was my experience. And I moved to California, where you heard about people like Bob Reading or Gene Guinan or other people here, and it felt like they should give you a cheat sheet. And I didn't know who the people were, and I didn't care, and I got angry and withdrawn, and I decided you all were doing it wrong. And I pulled away, which I don't recommend, and I had the very good fortune of not getting loaded. Dumb luck. Grateful for that. And when I was 8 years sober and I sort of managed to unravel everything that I put together, I went over to the Pacific Group because that was, by the way, there I go. If you're new and you don't know what the Pacific Group is, it's fine. We don't give a cheat sheet here. It's a large home group in Los Angeles. It's been my home group for 25 years, and it was active and enthusiastic, and I needed activity and enthusiasm. And I went over there, and I had a sponsor, but my sponsor had moved to Turkey to pursue art. And this is 25 years ago. We didn't really even have the internet back then. And I needed someone who could be in my face. And so I got Clancy to become my sponsor. Clancy, again, permission not to know, founded the Pacific Group. He got sober in 1958. He died in 2020 during the quarantine period. And I got active, and I got busy, and I got inconvenienced by Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you want the simplest thing that I've learned over 34 years, there are two things that I've learned. One is the actions don't care why I take them. And that if I take good actions in AA, I get good results. And if I take bad actions, I get bad results. And I have no other experience to share about that other than that. I am perfectly capable of rationalizing bad actions. But if they're bad, I get bad results. And if they're good, I get good results. And the other thing that I've learned has gone out of my mind because I'm almost 60, and increasingly that seems to be what happens, but it'll come back to me in a minute. And I remember now. It came back quicker than I thought. I should have bluffed for a moment longer. The best I can hope in AA is to be divinely inconvenienced. This was not on my triptych, and you may be happy that I'm here, you may not be, but basically I got the text last night, and I have learned, I've been well trained by people like Clancy and Matt and people here and people over, that if I can say yes to AA, I say yes to AA. I have three children that I raised on my own. My daughters are twins, they're graduating high school next month. If you ask me to speak on the night of your graduation, I'm going to politely tell you I can't do that, and if you have another time that works for you, I will. I don't not do my obligations, but I had a window to do this, and so I got on the 101 and saw your lovely Saturday afternoon beach traffic, and here I am, because the best I can hope, really, as somebody who suffers from a disease that tends to manifest as crippling self-obsession, is to have an opportunity to get out of self, to do things for others, to try to be useful. I've been sober 34 years. It turns out occasionally I am useful. I'm not sure I'm always useful. I'm sure that I try. And if you're new, I encourage you to try to be useful. I encourage you to let AA inconvenience you. I also want to tell you, somebody once said that that in AA, the first three times you steal something, you need to acknowledge it, and then it's yours. And 70% of what I'm saying, honestly, somebody else came up with. I just don't always remember who. Occasionally I'll throw out an attribution, but these are the things that I've learned over the years that I've been here. And Clancy was the founder of our group. He was a grumpy, tough old-timer. He was bright and really funny, and I discovered very quickly that I could make him laugh, and that gave me some wiggle room. And I also discovered that I wanted to be the person that he imagined me being. I'm gay, if you care or if you don't. And by the way, guys in particular, if you're uncomfortable now because you've been identifying with me, it doesn't mean you're gay. Unless you are. But it just means you're alcoholic. And when I got there to the sort of big, sort of hierarchical, traditional group, it felt to some degree like the gay guys were supposed to be sort of like the side characters, like charming and funny and nice, which is not always my strength, and comic relief. And Clancy hated that. He just wanted me to be in the mix. And I discovered I liked being in the mix. I had to go to the yard. I think it was you. I think it was you, Chris. The yard, again, here I go, with these things that you may not know. We used to get together in my home group every Saturday and play softball and volleyball, and I'm a really bad athlete. As a side note from that, I was here in Ventura 2 months ago. My son ran the marathon in 2 hours and 47 minutes. And, Look at 50% of my DNA produced a really good marathon runner. I'm not an athlete. I took me a year to get a hit at the yard. I was always in right field, which, if you don't know, is where you stick kind of like losers. And people were always saying, good job. And I think it was you, Chris, who one day I said, if someone says good job to me one more time, wouldn't believe me, I was doing nothing, I'm going to rip their effing head off. And he's like, dude, I don't know you. And I got into the mix, and my life changed. And I started sponsoring guys, and I've had the privilege of sponsoring a lot of people over the years. And that's a pleasure and a joy and an inconvenience. It is like a massive inconvenience and worth it. I don't have a sugarcoat. I don't like sugarcoating in AA. Like, we're not a self-help program. There's no magic mantra that fixes everything. Honestly, I've got money in the bank. If I could have bought a candle and lit it and been done, I would have done that. But what we have here, in my experience, is a series of actions and repetitions. And as Clancy used to say there, I go attributing, what AA does slowly is what alcohol and work used to do quickly. And but it stopped working, and this has not stopped working. I want to be candid about something. I'm a fan. I feel at 34 years, and certainly as people get longer, there's an opportunity to act like I walk on water and I'm perfect. I wish that was my experience. It's not been my experience. I still find that I'm very human, and I've had a very interesting experience. COVID, oddly enough, and as a side note, COVID was not the first pandemic that I went through in sobriety. When I got sober in New York in 1990, largely in downtown gay meetings, about a third of the people were actively dying. And if you had said AIDS is a moral failure, I would have fought you immediately. I would have been, but that didn't stop me from being confused, because I knew that I was a bad, defective person who had done terrible things, and therefore I deserved to be punished. And so it took me about a year to realize I didn't have AIDS at all, and I wasn't dying at all. And it was very confusing. And so I'd had the experience of being through one pandemic, and then we have this other pandemic. And I'm going to let you on the secret. I didn't like COVID. I didn't like it at all. I feel like some people hit their stride. They were like isolators, and Zoom was great, and they just loved it. I didn't like it, and I was home with three kids who all seemed to be like, you know, my son actually handled it perfectly, because my son handles everything perfectly, but my teenage daughters handled it terribly, and as many kids did, and it shook my faith. There. I'm the person who came to AA with a sense of a higher power and a comfort that came very easily from believing that there is some organizing principle to the universe that was not Alan B., and that I could rely on it. And I just had had that for a very long time. And to my surprise and frustration and anxiety, it kind of went away during COVID. And I felt very disconnected, and the world suddenly felt a little random and uncomfortable. And here's what I want to tell you from this vantage of 34 years. What I have that's a gift that you may not have quite yet when you're new, but you can, I promise you, you can get. I've been around so many great people in AA that when I'm not feeling it, I just know to get behind people who are feeling it and mimic their actions. it's good enough. And I trudged through a couple of years of what is this and why doesn't it feel as effortless and why do I feel like, you know, why do I feel like I'm sailing into a headwind all the time? And I'm pleased to report that a few months ago it shifted, and I feel the tailwind again. Honestly, they're all spiritual lessons in my experience, but I am sane enough and sober enough that I really prefer the spiritual lessons that feel like winning and cash and prizes. I'm not a huge fan of, like, growth through pain. I would suggest if you are, you try to let go of that, but sometimes that's what comes along. And my daughters just accepted their colleges. Here, Kevin will love this. I'm a single dad. I raised three kids on my own. My son's a sophomore in college, and one of my daughters is going to Denison, which is a really lovely liberal arts college in Ohio, and one of my daughters is going to Harvard. And I know, and and I'm the a-hole who, when my kid told me that they were, had gotten into Harvard, forgot to be excited because I was so stunned. And again, my DNA. And that's really nice. Really nice. Yeah. Well done, Alan. And I'm moving to Tennessee in the fall. I have a farm there and a boyfriend and goats and nursery plantings and there, I probably will feel comfortable being an old-timer. Here, you know, 34 years truly does feel kind of like a good start. But in Tennessee, it's a little bit different. Rural Tennessee. And it just feels like the world is coming back into position. I remember when I decided I was going to become a dad, and my kids were born from surrogacy, and Clancy was my sponsor, and Clancy had a reputation for being, I want to use a euphemism, old-fashioned. That's not what he had a reputation. He had a reputation for being a right-wing homophobe, and honestly, if you are, not there's anything wrong with that, but it's a little awkward when you're sponsored by somebody, and I went down to the mission, the Midnight Mission where he worked, to tell him what I was thinking about doing. And I want to remind you what I said earlier. I'm a big fan of lying. I'm a big fan of not telling you the truth. I don't believe that good things come from being open. That's not what I come from. My dad is a military intelligence officer. It's just not what I was raised with. But I went down to tell him what I was thinking to do. And because I was honest, I gave him the opportunity to be honest. And what he told me was that parenting was a really tough commitment. But he'd seen how I had honored my AA commitment, and that if I could bring that to parenting, he knew I'd be good, and he would have my support. I would have his support. And he was great. He was a curmudgeon. He loved to go to, like, Alabama for conferences and shock blue-haired ladies at, like, the banquet table telling them stories about me. But I turned out to be a good parent, and what an opportunity to get out of self and be of service. It's not the only one, but kids are narcissistic tyrants. They will force you into a life of service. And now they're grown up. And I still have a checkbook, so I'll hear, it's not really a checkbook anymore. It's like credit cards and Zelle and Venmo. But I'll hear from them. I'll get those Amazon requests, Dad, could you buy me this? So they're not going to forget me for a while, but I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank the Pendergrass, first of all, for being good AA brothers, as is Darren, and for dragging me up here today to share a little bit of my story with you. I want to say this. None of my children are currently in recovery. I don't know for a fact that any of them will need to be, but as a parent, I think a lot about how my life was saved by AA being what it was in 1990. And to me, at least, it was close enough to what it was in 1935 that it still worked. And I just want to say, with affection, but with also concern, I think we all have a responsibility to make sure that AA in 2024 offers people the same things, the steps, the actions, a spirit of respect for what we do here and how we help each other, and a a sense of optimism that hopeless, lost lives get redeemed and changed here into beautiful, productive lives. That's my story at 34 years. And so I want to thank you for having me and listening, and I'm really looking forward to hearing from Bob. Thank you.
And our next speaker is Bob R. from Oxnard.
Hi, everybody. I'm Bob, an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is January 24th, 1967. And I was raised a Roman Catholic. And I would like to inform Alan that I have been sober for 57 straight Passovers. And I had the great privilege, honor of speaking at the Pacific Group while, when Alan was the secretary. And I took my oldest daughter, Lynn, and Lynn and Alan struck it off right away because they both had adopted children, or children, well, however you describe it. My daughter adopted a young boy, and he's now a young man. And they shared some stories, and it really warmed my heart. And it's nice to see you. As Alan mentioned, we are both substitutes today. I'm Stephanie Johnson. Pinch hitting for Stephanie. And I've always given Matt a hard time, and he seemed to love it. He says he's always had another sponsor, but I know I've done all the heavy lifting with Matt for about the last 20 years. And he came down and played golf with me all the time, and we just had a great time. Anyway, I'm going to talk a little bit about my role in Alcoholics Anonymous. Some of us do different things in AA, and some sponsor a lot of people, and some people speak at a lot of meetings, and some of us are workers, and a lot of you don't realize it, but I was one of the workers. You know, I came in like Marina, and I got involved in general service, and I had a sponsor that got me involved. And I worked in general service for several years, and June was in the same time I was. And we worked at that. And later I worked on AA conventions. And I worked on AA conventions for about 40 years. And did all the jobs. All the jobs that came up, if I was available, I did them. When I came in, I mopped the floors. I washed ashtrays. When I came in, we washed coffee cups at the end of a meeting at Mason Lassen because their styrofoam hadn't been invented yet. So we had ashtrays and ceramic coffee mugs. So I came in early, and I think that one of the great things that's happened in my sobriety is the sponsorship I've had. When I came into AA, within 10 days, I had this sponsor named Father Ted out in the valley. And Father Ted was an alcoholic priest, had been sober 7.5 years, and he had a series of strokes. He was in his late 60s, which sounds pretty young to me now. And he shoveled along, but he was always getting these newcomers to drive him to meetings. And as soon as he met me, he found out that I graduated from Notre Dame, and so I guess that meant more indulgences for him if he'd get me to drive him, and if he kept me sober. So he grabbed me, and he said, "I need a ride home." So I drove him home that night, and he says, I let him out. He said, "I need a ride to Burbank tomorrow morning at noon." And so I took him to Burbank to the meeting, and that night he wanted to talk to me in his room. And the next morning we went back to Burbank at noon, and that night to the roving men's stag in the valley, and and then Monday night to the men's stag, and Tuesday night there was no meeting, so he had me come over to his room and talk to him again. Wednesday night back to another meeting, and Friday night the men's stag. And I went to 17 meetings in 14 days, hauling Father Ted's blood around. And but in those 14 days, I became somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous. I would walk into a meeting, and they'd have a seat for Father Ted and a seat for me as driver, you know. And I became somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous within 2 or 3 weeks. And so I sort of liked that. You know, I felt like somebody. And at the end of the 17th meeting and the 14th day, I said, same time tomorrow, Father. And he said, no. He says, I got another ride. And I thought, you ungrateful old goat. Here I've been saving his life for 14 days, and he dumps me like that. And the next night, I went and I... And the next night, I was going to stay home. I didn't know. You know, I was sitting home. All the meetings started at 8:30, and about 8:10, my wife at the time said, are you going to the meeting tonight? And I says, nope. He's going to be there with his new ride. And, 8:20, I couldn't take it anymore. I got in the car, and I drove to the meeting. It was only 5 minutes away. And I got to the meeting. I walked in, and there's Father Ted sitting in his seat. His new ride sitting in my seat. I saw these three old timers been sitting over in a corner, been sober 10, 11 months. And, so I went over to them before I could open my mouth. One of them said, he did it to you too, huh? 15 years later, I think it was 15 years, we all went to Father Ted's memorial in North Hollywood. And there was at least 500 former Father Ted drivers, several from the Pacific Group, including Chuck Nesbitt and John Pataka and others. And we had stories to share. You know, when they cut us out, the meeting ended at 9:30, and we went out in the parking lot at this Catholic church in North Hollywood, and we talked, and they locked up the parking lot at about 10:30, and we went over to Denny's, and at 2 o'clock in the morning, they threw us out of Denny's because we all had these stories. We all had our own Father Ted stories. But I need to tell you that Father Ted gave me the gift of AA meetings, going to AA meetings no matter what. Feel good, feel bad, feel nothing. Go to AA meetings. And when you continue to go to AA meetings, the ultimate thing is that you feel good. You're okay, you don't drink, and you're here. Hopefully for the long term. And that's been my experience. And Father Ted was the first sponsor. My second sponsor was Warren Snyder. And I met him when I was like 10 days sober. I went on a retreat. They suckered in me into going on this retreat down to Palos Verdes, couples retreat. And and I met Warren and Betty Snyder and Chuck and Elsa Chamberlain. And Chuck C. Later became my sponsor, but after Father Ted dumped me about 3 months later, I was looking for a sponsor, and I called Warren, and he took me under his wing, and little did I know that he had been a delegate to New York, and he's the one that jammed me into general service, and I was answering phones at the central office, and I became the secretary of the men's stag meeting at 6 months, and the big speaker meeting in the valley, at a year, that was the meeting that became Mason and Lassen, and it's still going. And so I just got involved in everything, and it just kept me busy. Along that way, I was really anxious to get caught up. I mentioned that I graduated from high school, and I was an outstanding student in high school, and I didn't drink much. So my sophomore year, and then I couldn't drink much after that because I didn't get in trouble all the time. And so I got good grades, and I was accepted everywhere, and I should have applied to Harvard, damn it. But I was accepted at Cornell and Brown and Notre Dame and Fordham and everywhere else, and that I applied. And but it was a dream of every Irish Catholic family in New England to send their son to Notre Dame. And so I was the son that got to go to Notre Dame. And in my freshman year, I was like the all-state honor boy, because I couldn't get out. They lock you in the dormitories at 10 o'clock at night and turn off the electricity at 11 o'clock at night. And so I couldn't get out. And so I got good grades and I did well. By my sophomore year, I found a way out the fire escape and into town and so on. And I was on disciplinary and academic probation for the last 3 years I was at school. But it was bred into me that you finish what you start. It was this Irish Catholic culture, I guess, that I just couldn't let my parents down. And so when I'd been drinking and just doing nothing for two-thirds of the semester, the last two or three weeks of the semester, I stopped drinking and sober up and study hard and pass my exams. And so I got through. I graduated on time. And that's another story there. I wasn't allowed to go to my own graduation. My mother had taken the train out from Massachusetts to see me graduate. And the morning of the graduation, they announced to me that I wasn't allowed to go up on the stage and get my diploma. Instead, they mailed it to me 2 weeks later. It broke my mother's heart. But it mended her heart slowly over the decades later into Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything in AA seemed to happen slowly. I don't know if you ever noticed that. If you've been around long enough, when you become a real old timer, Alan, you'll understand that good things come to people that wait. Anyhow, I graduated from there, and then I went to Navy OCS in Newport, Rhode Island. They locked you up for 18 weeks, couldn't get out of alcohol, passed, became an officer in the Navy, and served for 4.5 years in the Navy, and got an honorable discharge. Well, I wasn't a star student in the Navy, because once they let me out of OCS, I could get downtown. But nonetheless, my first service set up. First tour of duty was in Ethiopia. I went to Ethiopia for a year and a half, or thereabouts. And then I was transferred to the Pentagon. I worked in the Chief Naval Operations Communications Office for the next year and a half, or thereabouts. And finally, my time was up, and I got an honorable discharge. I was let out of the Navy, and I looked like a phenomenal resume, you know, when I got out. But I was full of acid in the sense that I'd never taken any drugs, never have taken any drugs, but I drank to the point of I was a blackout drinker. And I have to find my car, and I had to ask people what happened the previous night or the previous couple of days. And it was humiliating, but somehow I struggled through, and right after I got out of the Navy, I got married to the about a month before I got married, one of my drinking buddies said, you know, if you got married, you wouldn't drink so much. Well, it only took a month for me to get married, and that didn't work. The marriage worked for a while. But, anyway, I have two daughters, and my business career, I'm going to keep track of this. Let me look. My business career after I got out of the Navy was a checkered, to say the least. I wanted to get caught up, you know, because I'd had all that drinking, and I was ambitious and maybe a little pushy, Linda. And I kept getting fired from jobs, and I wanted my boss's job as soon as I got a job, and he figured it out. The next thing I knew, I was gone. And that happened a couple of times, two or three times. And finally, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought, well, this is my chance, you know. I can finally, you know, reach some goals. And so I worked real hard at this job for a year, and I got fired. A year sober, sort of humiliating. So I got another job, and I kept it for 9 months. And they called me in on a Tuesday, and they said, we just sold the company, and you make the most money, so we're going to let you go first. And they fired me out here 9 months later. And so I went out and got another job, and I kept it for 5 years. And it was a really good job. I worked hard at it, and they said, you're going to be the youngest manager in the company, and so on. And my boss knew that it was his job that I was looking for. And anyway, after 5 years, they called me in and fired me after 7 years of sobriety. And I thought, screw this. I went out and started my own company, and I did not get fired for the next 48 years. 2 years ago, I sold that company. Now, the number of years here, I might miss them by one or two, but you get the drift. 2 years ago, a little less than 2 years ago, I sold the company after 49 years and 8 months, and I have enough money to live the rest of my life. As long as I only live 3 more years. Matt and I have the same problem. We're trying to live to our last dollar. But my life has been good in that sense, too. Anyway, Warren became my sponsor, as I said, backing up a little. And he was my sponsor for a couple of years. And then he got galloping leukemia. And he was dead in 5 days. And he had gotten me involved in everything in AA. And I called his wife, Betty, and I said, I don't know what to do. I don't know where to turn. She said, go see Chuck. I said, you don't just go see Chuck. And so she said, well, that's the only thing I can tell you. So about a month later, I called Chuck, and he remembered me because he lived right across the driveway from Betty and Warren from Chuck and Elsa. And so he said, come on down here at 10 o'clock on Sunday morning. So I got there at 10 o'clock. He opened the door. We sat down. I started to explain my problems for about a minute and a half, and he interrupted me, and he talked for the next 4 hours. And all we did was go to the bathroom and drink coffee and listen to him talk. And I don't know what it was he said. I can't tell you anything particular that he said today, but it was the drift. It was a spiritual plane that I had that didn't know existed. And sounds like they're coming after us. That only happens when I lie. So you hear any more motorcycles, and you know another lie, Bob. It's like ring a bell, like angel gets its wings. So anyway, Chuck became my sponsor for the next 15 years. And some people would tell you that Chuck C. didn't sponsor anybody. Well, they don't know. They're wrong. I was on the retreat in 1975 where they made the tapes for New Pair of Glasses, and where they made, which became the book, A New Pair of Glasses. And there were 63 or 64 of us, and 25 of us were sponsored by Chuck C. And he never denied it. He drove all the way up to the valley once a year to give me my cake on my birthday and to speak. So he became my sponsor. And I learned so much from him that was useful in my life in Alcoholics Anonymous, and none that was not useful. You know, if I understood it, applied it, got it working in my life, then I could move forward. And his big thing was forgiveness. And he talked about forgiveness all the time, surrender. Surrender and forgiveness were synonymous with Chuck. And he would tell me something was completely opposite anything I was thinking about. I sponsor 2 guys now. I sponsor 30 guys and 1 woman. The woman has to be in this room. But the 30 guys, 2 of them, I say, when I answer the phone, I see their names on the phone. I answer the phone, and the first thing I say is, tell her you're sorry. I don't say, hi, Mike. I said, tell her you're sorry. I got a guy in Florida, and he called me, and I said, tell her you're sorry. And there's silence for about 5 seconds. Okay. Oh, I forgot where I was going with that. I got another guy, Charlie C., when he calls me, we talk about it. I burn... not incense, what's the other? I burn sage before I'll answer the phone. I have to purify this thing because this phone, he called me a little, I thought it was about noon, and I'm watching the Dodger game today. And he called me at noon, and I'm thinking, I better start burning, I'm looking for some sage. And I answered the phone. We started talking, and I said, hey, I got to be over there at 2:15. I said, it must be about noon or so, isn't it? And he says, it's 1:04. So, fortunately, I only live 6 miles away, so I got here on time. So anyway, I burn sage when Charlie calls and tell the other guys to tell her you're sorry. And there's a lot of, see, I got another guy in North Hollywood or there about that area, and he calls me. The poor guy, he's so verbose, talks all the time. he gets on the phone, he wants to talk an hour. And so I say, when he calls, I say, Mark, your word today is brevity. And he goes quiet. And then he's learned it, you know. He's learned it. So now he called me a couple weeks ago, and he said, tell me about a problem he had. And I said, you know what I wish for you? Because he's got this motor that is going up. It's like a Grand Central head. And I said that what I wish for you is a calm, peaceful life. And he's been replying to that one statement for the last couple of weeks, that's what he wants in his life now. He wants a calm, peaceful life. He doesn't want that Grand Central head that with 65 railroad tracks in your head with a locomotive on each one with a whistle blowing. And that's not what I'm looking for in Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyhow, moving along to a new sponsor. Chuck C. died, and I had a couple of real brief sponsors looking for the right one, and then I got a man named Frank O. From Orange County. He became my sponsor. He was another disciple of Chuck C., and he became my sponsor for about, I guess, 15 years. I don't know the numbers right offhand, but it was a while. And he passed away about 10 years ago, thereabouts. Then I got Bob Lemke. Bob Lemke remained my sponsor until the middle of the pandemic, and then he passed away. By the way, for those that Alan brought up the pandemic, it's not true that I was not in two pandemics. I was only in this one. I was not in the one in 1918 that some people accused me of. So. There have been two. So, but Bob Lemke became my sponsor, and he was a good sponsor. And we were good friends, you know. When we've been sober a long time, our sponsors become our friends, too. And about 10 years ago or so, or somewhere in there, Frank O'Rourke died, and I got a call from Jim McNally. And Jim McNally was a judge from Santa Barbara. I was sober 50 years, 51. He just died a few months ago. And he called me and he said, hey, I know you're close to Frank, and they're having a memorial for him down at the Elks in Santa Ana. I know it's a long drive. I thought maybe you and I, we've known each other all this time. I thought maybe we could go together. I said, sure. So I said, you want me to pick you up? He said, no, I'll have to drive. But he was paralyzed from the waist down. And so he had a scooter in the back of his car, or van. And so he said, I have to drive. So I said, okay. So he picked me up, and we drove down there, and we had the most phenomenal conversation in the next 3 hours or more. Just driving down from here to Santa Ana, you got to go through L.A. in the middle of the morning traffic. And we didn't care about the traffic. We got caught up on things and our belief systems and everything else and how similar we were. He was an Irish Catholic guy that came out of Iowa, and he got polio, and he lost his ability to walk. However, when we were all back, it was a 2-hour drive back home, and we got about 15 minutes away from my house. And he said, you know, Bob, he said, something I don't say very much is, he said, I am so grateful for everything in my life, particularly AA. He said, but when I look back on it, he said, I'm grateful for my polio. It just took my breath away. I said, how can you say that? He said, it enabled me to be the first in my family. I was born on a farm in Iowa. And it was an unpaved road out to our farm. He said, and nobody in my family ever graduated from college. And nobody ever got any advanced degree. He said, the state of Iowa, because I had polio, sent me to college. And they sent me to law school. And I was able to become a lawyer and a judge, all because of the polio that got me off the farm. Or else I might still be on that farm in Iowa. And he said, and that's one reason why I'm so grateful. And the fullness of the goodness of his life was just breathtaking. And so a few years ago, I gave him a call and I said, about maybe a year after Lemke died, I called Jim. I said, Jim, I know I'm sober a couple of years longer than you, but I really like your sobriety and I really need a sponsor to be accountable to. So would you be my sponsor? And he said, I'd be honored. I thought, what a well-chosen, kind word to say, I'd be honored. So he became my sponsor. And so these men all taught me something. I learned my lessons in Alcoholics Anonymous by listening to those people and following their example. And Chuck's used to say, he said, everything I do, I give it all my interest, attention, and love. And I said, well, he said, I do. He said, even brushing my teeth, I give all my interest, attention, and love. Well, I'll tell you, I shouldn't tell you this story, but yesterday I played in a golf tournament, this AA golf tournament with these two Prendergast guys and some other ringer they brought in. And I figured, you know, we might win with these three good golfers, but they had me. You know, and it was, I'm telling you, it was like elder abuse. You see what those guys did? They dragged me around that course for 5.5 hours, and we finished in third place, fourth place out of 30 teams. And I'm thinking, if they had anybody that was just a little bit better, they might have won the thing. They seemed happy that they had me along. I don't know why, but these are the types of people, these are the types of friends you get with Alcoholics Anonymous. My wife's not here. She's not feeling well this afternoon. So I'll tell you a little story. About 1994, I lived in the Valley until 1994. But in 1988, I came out here and I ran a half marathon, as a matter of fact, and right down by the beach. And I saw there were lots of homes that were available and beach lots. I couldn't afford a beach lot, but I looked around and I found the home. And I thought, this would be nice to have to, you know, maybe retire in or whatever. And so I bought a house down by the beach in Oxnard Shores, about 6 miles away. And in 1994, my youngest daughter graduated from college, and so she didn't have to come home anymore, so I moved out here with the wife I had at the time. And we lived out here, and in 1994, I went to a speaker meeting over in Camarillo on a Thursday night. And this woman came up to me and she said, you're the Purple Panther guy from the spoke at the Pacific group. And I used to coach a team, a little girl softball team called the Purple Panthers. And she remembered the Purple Panther guy, and I said, well, yeah, that's right. And so we talked and we were friendly, and then it turned out we were both married to other people at the time, and so that we honored those relationships right up till the end. And that was 1994. Well, 2010, neither one of us married anybody else. And it took us about a month to get together. And we've been together ever since. And she's been sober 47 years, and I've been sober 57 years. And it's the most kind, loving relationship you could ever imagine. And we try not to, we're so good to each other, we're so thoughtful of each other, and I'm blessed beyond description. And about 2 years ago, I said to her, I said, Sue, I said, isn't it a shame that we didn't meet, you know, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and have this whole life together? And she looked at me and she said, you'd still be in prison. She said, I was 13 when you sobered up. So I would still be in prison. But we've been together ever since, and she was with me here last night, and I think she'll be back here with me tomorrow for the meetings. And I should never tell you this story. You'll never invite me back. So I'm going to tell you this story. For about the last 5 years, at most of these roundups and conventions out here, I've been a long timer, and I really don't like those countdowns. I don't like being, you know, I don't like to have to pass the book to the newcomer 3 years in a row, same guy. And that's happened. Anyway, I forgot what I was going to say. Anyway, last year, they mercifully, but the three women got up the courage. They drove down to L.A. and they picked up this woman in a wheelchair that had a year or two more than I did. And they wheeled her up here. They couldn't get her up on the podium, so they parked her down front so she could give the newcomer the book. And everybody thought I would be sad. And I was so grateful. I hope they will get her tomorrow so I don't have to go through that again. That was a bad story. I'm sorry. I'll tell you a good story and I'll sit down. Let's send you home early. How's that? I sobered up and I went through the different phases, and I met June when she was 13, 14 years old. She used to come up to our meeting in the valley, and I saw her later on in about that time in general service. Everywhere I went, she was. I go to a speaker meeting and sent in Pasadena, not to speak, but to go there, and June shows up from Venice, which is like, you know, going from New York to Ohio. So, anyway, June's there. Everywhere you went, you find June. You go to a convention in Torrance, and there's June, and everywhere. So I thought she had my calendar. So anyway, she'd come up, and she'd come to our meeting, and then we would go up to Caro's after the meeting, and we'd all sit there and we'd have coffee and pie, and June would eat a hamburger and French fries and a Coke, and it's probably the only meal she had that day. And if we find that she hitchhiked her way up there, which is like, you know, like 30 miles in hard miles, and at the end of the meeting, we get up and we go out, and June would go across the street and start hitchhiking back to Venice at 1 o'clock in the morning, 12:30, 1 o'clock in the morning. And when I saw it, I just couldn't let it happen. And so I called my wife, and I said, who was home, and I said, hey, I won't be home for another hour. She said, what? What? I said, I got to drive June back to Venice. She said, oh, June, okay. June was not a threat to our marriage. But she opened up all of our hearts, and we all came to love her. And when I was sober, about 12 years, that marriage was breaking up, and I just went out to start jogging around the high school track down near my house, and I started running a quarter of a mile, and I was exhausted. One loop around the high school track. The next night, same thing, another mile, a half, quarter of a mile. Within a few weeks, I could run a mile and a half. And I was feeling pretty good, you know. And so, as with us alcoholics, anything worth doing is worth doing to excess. 11 months later, I found myself lined up to run the Hang 10 Marathon in Griffith Park. And I did not run it in 2 minutes and 54 seconds. Two hours, 54 minutes. But I ran the best I could, and I wanted to finish the thing. It was just, I was so determined because I was so sad going through the divorce, seemingly leaving the two daughters, and that lasted about 3 days. Then ultimately they both came to live with me. But I lined up and I started running, and I run out to half marathon. So I ran out to 13 and a half miles, and I saw my car, and I felt pretty good, and I got to 15 and a half miles. And I saw my car for the last time, and I thought, this is okay, you know. And I got to 20 miles, and I heard these stories about marathoners hitting the wall at 20 miles. And so I thought, you know, must be lesser people than me. And so I all of a sudden I felt like Mr. Potato Head, like somebody pushed a button in my forehead and all my parts were falling off. My knee was grinding, everything hurt, and I had 6 miles to go. So I started, so I slowed down, and I ran the last 6 miles the best I could, and I got right up near the finish line. I'm like 300 yards from the end of the run, and they string those plastic flags like they have at a supermarket opening for the last couple hundred yards, and you run down there and people cheer your effort and all that. And so I, you know, all your friends and relatives, of which I have none. So running down there, and I get about halfway down there, and people start applauding, and then they start screaming and yelling. Some guy yelled, "Here comes a woman!" I look over my shoulder, and this long-legged woman is bearing down on me. I hadn't seen a woman in 45 minutes. All my macho came back, and no way I'm going to let her pass me. So I start running like hell, and she rolls right up on my shoulder, and she says, "Bob Regan, Bob Regan." And I look, and it's June G. And I said, "Why do you wait 26 miles and humiliate me in front of all these people?" And she said, "I didn't run the race. I just saw you go by, so I said, I'm going to run." God bless you all. I wish you a great, wonderful day.